This is Spectrum.
Alternative medicine, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Well, Tom, how you doing? Another week gone by?
Yes, it has. I'm good. A little tired, but alive.
It's because you work 15 hours a day and think you can stay up all night.
Yep.
Well, we got Michael Tellinger with us here today. And you've got a bio on him. Could you please just give us some info on him?
Yes, Scott. Michael is a scientist in the true sense of the word, never shying away from controversial issues and scrutinizing every clue meticulously. After a 30-year-long obsession with the origins of humankind and the genetic anomalies of our species, he wrote Slave Species of God. When Johan Haney exposed the mysteries of the stone ruins of South Africa to Michael in 2007, they began an irreversible process of research that led Michael to some startling scientific conclusions and the completion of two more books, Adam's Calendar and Temples of the African Gods. So let's welcome Michael.
Hello, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Scott. Thanks very much, Tom. Nice to be finally talking to you after quite an extended period of trying to set this up.
Yes.
Yeah. And we were mixing our dates up and everything. Yeah, it was great. I'm glad to finally have you on the show. I'm a big fan of the Slave Species of God and the ancient theories around that. There's a lot of authors writing about it. And perhaps you could start off by giving us a bullet point introduction into how you got into the field of that research and where that research took you.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think like most people who get involved in this field of work and research is really a sequence of events and inquiring mind, asking simple questions and finding they have very complex answers. And the history books that exist at school and at university do not provide the answers that we're looking for. And so I started researching and reading alternative authors and researchers, people like Eric von Däniken, who I still really believe needs to be commended for his pioneering work in this field, because when he started putting together the theories that he started to find based on his research, there was no genetic engineering, and there was very little information that we have today.
Right.
There was no internet and so forth, and he was able to pull together this basic foundation, which still stands today.
It does. And the massive backlash that he experienced while doing that, he took the brunt for a lot of future researchers.
Exactly. And look, it's still happening. It hasn't stopped completely. It's just greatly reduced, and I think it's fizzling out at a rapid rate. More and more people are waking up and realizing that, history of this planet is not what we were taught. It is a very different story. And that's really what drove me to write Slave Species of God, to pull together a lot of different information, different work from various authors who have presented their cases, and then my own research to be thrown into that in a way that I felt presented it more concisely, and pulling together slightly different areas as well that I felt some of the other authors did not necessarily do, like bringing in anatomy and genetics together with religion and the metaphysical aspect of things, including the physical aspect of things and so forth.
The amazing thing about this, I think Tom would agree, that different authors who are doing, and researchers who are doing work in these areas, always add their own pieces to the puzzle. They have interests in different areas, and it helps to fill in the puzzle, as it were, because each person is dedicated and look into different aspects of things, like, you know, Zachariah Sitchin, who recently passed on, did a great deal of scholarly work on the Sumerian stuff, added, of course, his own flavor to it, and, you know, other researchers in the past, of Eric Van Daniken, you mentioned, added his pieces to the puzzle, and you came. Maybe we could get a rundown of what, how you feel your individual contributions have added to the research, and not just, I mean, you've also compiled a whole bunch of everybody else's stuff too.
Yeah, I think the most important thing that's happened to me is that looking through Zachariah Sitchin's work and using a lot of his interpretations, I was inspired to go looking for more information, and it was at that point that miraculously somehow I met up with Johann Heine, who introduced me to the stone circles of South Africa, as they're commonly called, the stone circles, the ancient ruins of Southern Africa. He was introduced to them by another guy called Cyril Hromnik, probably, you know, a decade or so before that. And Cyril Hromnik himself goes back many years to the early 80s. He published a book in 1981 called Indo-Africa, where he shows the immense influence of Hindu Dravidians on the Southern African history in the last 2,000 and maybe even as far back as 4,000 years ago. The Hindu Dravidians that were intricately involved in gold mining and trading of gold in Southern Africa.
Yeah, there's that gold connection.
Exactly. And then when I got exposed to the stone circles, I instantly somehow knew in my gut feel, you know, we get these aha moments, right?
Yeah.
And right. I had one of those, and I realized that this is very important information and a link to the work that I covered in Slave Species of God. And within 6 months to 12 months after first exploring or discovering the stone circles and going out on my own and researching them and walking up and down many mountains and studying them, just often just sitting outside staring at the circles or inside looking at the intricacy of them and the simplicity of them, trying to figure out what the hell is going on here, what is this all about, slowly but surely allowing that information to filter through, and I suppose also downloading and channeling some information for those that are open enough to that kind of information.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I was led and guided to the conclusions that I was then able to make at a later stage. And I don't know, you know, these things happen in a way that when you look at it afterwards, you go, how did that happen? If you could have planned it yourself, you could not have planned it better or in a more orderly way, because it seems to have just unfolded exactly the way it's meant to unfold.
Exactly. Yeah, I've heard this over and over, people and researchers who go to the areas where they're trying to research something and get struck with, like you said, a download, basically. They open themselves up to the information stream. They're connected or standing in the spot that they're researching, and boom, they're open and they're curious. They're willing to know the information. They're curious and wanting to know. And the universe says, okay, here you go.
Yeah.
You know, and they get the information that way. So how did the gold in those areas connect and the circles?
Well, you know, people need to remember that gold is inextricably linked to the origins of humankind. We cannot separate our obsession with gold from the very first, the earliest days of Adam in the Bible. and Genesis 2, you know, when Adam had hardly been created, already there's an expression by God with his obsession for gold. And this reminds us, you know, let me remind your listeners that all the ancient cultures, whenever they were discovered by the European conquistadores or the explorers and the colonialists, the what I call the nasty people from Europe in the past 500 years that have caused all the damage all over the world, pretty much.
Yep.
When they came upon the native populations around the world and found their large stashes of gold, when they asked them, who does the gold belong to, the answer was always the same. The gold belongs to the gods.
Yeah.
And we must not take that lightly. And obviously, for those people that are familiar with this area of work and research will understand exactly what that means.
Right.
The gold never belonged to the humans. It does not belong to us. We're the accidental byproduct as a species linked to the mining and the production of gold. And somehow we are now, through our ignorance and dumbing down process that we've been exposed to, have come to believe that the gold belongs to us. It's our gold, and we, you know, but that's never been the case. And remember that most of the gold in the world in the last 100 years or 150 years has come out of South Africa or Southern Africa, South Africa and Zimbabwe.
Yep. Zimbabwe.
And this has not just been the last 150 years or so. This has been in the last 280,000 years. And that's the research that I found.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing.
Why do you think the conventional archaeology doesn't understand or follow, you know, the conclusions that you have come and many others?
I think, Tom, the answer to that is not a pleasant answer. And unfortunately, to be totally honest in answering that question, one has to probe really deeply into the control systems on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people ask straightforward questions and they expect a straightforward, simple answer, but that's not unfortunately the case.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
Never is.
And so why has the mainstream academia and so forth not you know, responded, or why don't they share the same sentiments? Well, let's look at who the mainstream academia is. These are the universities. Where do the universities come from and get their funding from? They get their funding from governments, and the people get their jobs, and they get paid by the governments. Who is in the government? The politicians, and who represent the vested interests of the large corporations, who control the purse strings of that economy. So it's an incestuous cycle of control. So the people that are at universities apparently or supposedly promoting the concept of education and the advancement of knowledge are actually doing completely the opposite. And this has become a hot topic of debate more and more that I do my presentations and talks, and I get, you know, really acclaimed physicists and scientists that come to my presentations all over the world. I just had such an experience in San Francisco and Oakland, where I had an amazing physicist and an electrical engineer that came to my presentations there, and especially the physicist, you know, he actually came out in absolute support of my sentiments, explaining from his perception how the halls of academia have actually become the halls of dogma.
Well, yeah, because I mean, for the longest time right now, and even now, I suppose, you know, there's still a hole as to where, you know, humans came. There's still this gap or you know, missing time, you know, where. So, you know, if you look at all the other evidence that you know, can be acceptable, based on, you know, what you find and many others, you know, that could solve some of those riddles that these guys are still holding on to.
Absolutely. And it's a lot of independent scientists working outside the mainstream academia and research who are working on their own without government funding, without funding from these major corporations and corporate funding. So, you know, there's a huge difference in the vested interest. And archaeology has been guilty of this for as long as archaeology has been around. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, I must remind people that archaeology does not come out of a noble origin. It comes out of a very disgusting and dirty, ugly origins of archaeology, mm-hmm. where the early archaeologists were treasure hunters. Grave robbers and treasure hunters, and they were funded by wealthy individuals, the royal elite and the aristocrats around the world who had infinite supplies of money, who could fund them to travel to exotic locations around the world and go desecrate sacred sites of indigenous populations and bring back whatever loot they could lay their hands on, decimate the local population, destroy valuable evidence. And this is the story of the last 500 years.
And hasn't religion played a big part in part of the destruction and part of the belief systems that have been created, and even the way academia is looking at it right now?
Of course it has. I mean, religion, just like education, religion is probably the number one tool of segregation and separation of the human race. Once again, what I mean by that, to explain to your listeners, is that we are a highly divided species. We are so divided on so many levels that it is almost impossible to define. We have become so divided that we forget that we come from a unified field. Right. And this is where things get really interesting. And this is why, although I'm researching ancient civilizations and trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together of what you mentioned earlier, the missing elements of who are we, where do we come from, why are we here, the simple questions that we are not able to answer and we should be able to answer. Mm-hmm. But while I'm researching this, I find that I have to delve into every other area of research and knowledge, whether it's history, whether it's astronomy, whether it's astrology, whether it's physics, whether it's quantum physics or metaphysics or psychic ability and conspiracy theories. I've got to be able to delve into all these areas to try and make sense of this mess that we find ourselves in.
It's like a spider web, isn't it?
It's huge. You know, the layers of deception that have been planted and promoted and enforced over thousands and thousands of years, mm-hmm. are so staggering that when the average person on the street first comes face to face with this, they're so overwhelmed and so baffled by it that they just refuse to believe it, because it is so absolutely complete in its tying us up in ignorance.
Well, I find that, you know, religion plays such a big part in a lot of this that, you know, if you were to go and tell somebody, you know, here's my findings, you know, the first thing they're going to tell you is that, well, you know, but the Bible says, you know, Adam and Eve and such. And if you know, you're talking to a Muslim, he's going to say again similar type of things and so on and so forth. They tend to always fall back in those areas which have been, you know, inbred into us for hundreds of years.
Well, that's a very important point, because I often tell Christians when they start, you know, I'm talking, referring now to reborn Christians, because even by using the word religion, you're already creating confusion.
Nice. Because, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Because within religious movements, there are those enlightened ones and there are the dogmatic ones. They're the ones that are confused, that are just, you know, floating down the river, not knowing what the hell's going on. Okay, and what I find fascinating is that the Bible, and when religious people like Christians approach me and they start newborn or reborn Christians, and they start spewing forth their you know, their dogma.
The quotes, they can quote, like...
Yeah, and quoting, you know, verbatim from the Bible and following it word for word, not understanding what it means. I find it fascinating when you start explaining to them that you actually know the Bible as well as they do, and that you understand the meaning of what they've just told you, but it actually means something else. And when I tell them that I am a Christian to the bone, I actually believe fundamentally and 100% in the Christ consciousness philosophy and in the message of Christ, it shakes them at their core, because they don't expect to hear that.
Exactly.
And you see, that is the beautiful crossroads that we have now reached, where the misunderstanding, and that's actually all it is taking advanced, sacred, and encoded information that is put into the books like the Bible, and the Quran as well contains a lot of that information. Sometimes people forget about that. Mm-hmm. And all the other ancient sacred texts from the Hindus and the Vedas and even African folklore stories that are linked.
From the point of view of a Christian to a dogmatic Christian point of view, the fact that you mentioned those other books is sort of heresy, isn't it? I mean, well, I'm coming from a dogmatic point of view. You mentioned the Quran, the Vedas, maybe the Nag Hammadi, the Bhagavad Gita, the Rig Veda, yada, yada, yada. I mean, that would be like, well, why would you read those if you're a Christian, right? You see the dogmatic thinking in that?
Yeah, totally, and they do that. But what I find interesting is the moment you engage the Christians on this and you explain to them your understanding of what it means, I'm beginning to find that a lot of them are opening up to this information, because I don't attack them. I don't try and bring down their belief system. I explain to them that I actually believe and read the same literature, but I have a slightly different understanding of what it's telling me, and explain to them why it is that in Genesis 2, you know, that there was darkness and nothing else, and then Genesis 3, that's the voice of God that says, "Let there be light," and explain the meaning of this and what it all means to our understanding and how it links to science and physics and the quantum physics and then other beautiful examples of the Bible. I mean, in Hebrews 11, God, we are reminded that God made that which is seen from that which is not seen or unseen. And it's just like a quick reminder of quantum physics and the infinite field of quantum possibility. And these are just two tiny examples of huge amounts of information encoded into the Bible, which, as you know, is so deeply encoded in advanced knowledge and information that it boggles the mind.
Right.
And I think it's, you know, what I find very encouraging at this stage of our point in as a species is that we're beginning to realize, and this has been shown with scientific experiments, various people like David Wilcock and in some interviews that I've heard with Dan Burish have been, and a few others as well, have referred to this thing called consciousness, and I think consciousness as a concept is a hugely important subject for us to embrace.
Right.
But this thing called consciousness has no boundaries. It does not discriminate. Whether you're a dogmatic Christian or a suicidal Muslim or a confused Buddhist or whatever the hell you are, consciousness does not discriminate. Or whether you're a malicious politician, you know, and at Capitol Hill, you will be affected, and you are affected on a second-by-second basis by this thing called consciousness, the same way that everybody else is. Consciousness cannot be stopped or blocked by putting yourself into a Faraday cage, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's activating our DNA. It is stimulating our DNA. It comes to us through various sources and frequencies and light that is referred to as radiant and not frequency-based, so that it cannot be blocked. And it's spectacular information, and I believe it's this consciousness that seems to be the fabric that allows the universe to exist. I often refer to as consciousness as the Holy Spirit, or the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So it's the Holy Spirit aspect of the Holy Trinity that is responsible for the manifestation of the visible or the projected universe. And I think it's this consciousness that is just, for me personally, it's the most exciting concept that I've embraced in the last few years. And just growing into trying to understand more and more about it is a very exciting process.
It's funny, I had a comment the other day in one of our interviews that people have difficulty in throwing consciousness off planet, that they try to contain the concept of consciousness or conscious awareness and hold it onto Earth, that just, you know, Earth-centered consciousness. But throwing it out into space and, you know, giving that consciousness to other beings and other planets and is maybe a step too far for some people.
Well, I'd like to remind them of the following thing, because the other step too far for some people is when you start pointing out people that everything is consciousness. Whether it's the table that I'm resting on, or the chair that I'm sitting on, or the tree in the garden, or the car, the engine, the fuel, the cable that's running out of my computer, the jersey that I'm wearing, everything is consciousness. And this throws a lot of people, and they go, how can you say that? You know, I mean, I can take an axe and chop up this piece of wood, and it's just a piece of wood. And that's just a rock, you know. How can you tell me a rock has got consciousness? And the best way to describe that is to just break things down and take it back to source. Okay, now remember that everything comes from source. Whether your source is God, whether it's God that made it, or whether it's the Big Bang or the universe that came out of a point, out of a vacuum, as Nassim Haramein calls it, or various other bright people that have looked at this in great detail. That's the finding that the conclusions that I reach is that, you know, things just materialize out of nowhere, bang, and here they are. Here's the universe, just out of nowhere, out of nothing. So what is the fundamental particle of the universe? All the matter that we see around us is made up of molecules, which are made up of atoms, which are made up of electrons. And the electrons, whatever they're made up of, okay, let's not go down that rabbit hole. But basically everything in the universe is made up of the same electrons. It's just the configuration and the arrangement of the electrons that then become a table or a chair or a tree or me or you or a computer or the air around us. So it's just an arrangement of electrons, but it's the same electrons that were activated out of this infinite quantum soup of possibility and manifest itself as physical matter. Now that's what I call consciousness. That's not consciousness. I mean what consciousness gives it the ability to happen. So all the electrons come out of the same primordial source of consciousness. So they're all equally conscious. So everything is consciousness. Doesn't matter what it is.
Smaller and smaller bits of consciousness. However, you know, maybe the new Hadron Collider will come up with smaller bits of consciousness.
I have a problem with that Hadron Collider thing and the collision. This is just, you know, that's Newtonian physics at its ugliest. Smashing physical things together to see, you know, the small particles. That's actually immaterial what they find. Right. I believe that the important thing here is the structure of the matter. And for that, we've got to go to the laws of nature. And the laws of nature are beautifully expressed in the subject we call sacred geometry.
Yeah.
And it's also important to remind people that And Tom, you should be aware of this. Coming, I believe you have Greek heritage, origin.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The word sacred in Greek doesn't mean religious. It actually, the original meaning in Greek is fixed. One of the main meanings of the word sacred in Greek is fixed. Fixed geometry. Religious geometry, but it's fixed geometry, as fixed by the divine process of creation, or the creator, or what I would call preferably the laws of nature.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's an interesting side note. Okay, just, wow, we're bouncing around, which is great.
But you see, the point, what I'm trying to point out to you here is we started talking about ancient civilizations and stone ruins in South Africa, and see how quickly it moves into a different direction, because it's all connected.
Yeah.
And if you're not able to pull those connections together, unfortunately, most of the academics at the institutions are very focused in their specific area, and they do not have the opportunity to diversify and digress into all these other areas and you know, inform themselves or be up to date with the latest discoveries and in all the different areas of science. If you can't do that, you will never be able to put together this storyline of the origins of humankind. It's not possible.
You have to be a generalist.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, specialists are great, but they'll be eventually so specialized, they'll know more and more about, you know, they'll know more and more about nothing, you know. They'll know one thing, but they'll know everything there is to know about that one thing. And then again, they're just scratching the edge of it.
But you see, the thing is that it's okay to be a specialist. But
we need those details.
As long as you are able to use the information and the research that you've gained in your specialized field, and then be able to plug it into the greater pool of information. If you can't do that, then what are you doing? You just you're like a blind rabbit going down your own rabbit hole.
Right. It's strange, because I was talking to someone recently, and he was saying how he was with a tribe in Peru that want nothing to do with modern society. And was it Peru or Brazil? I'm trying to remember now. Anyway, they wanted nothing to do with the outside world. And when he was with them, he said that when they spoke, they talked of themselves as not human. And not human in the sense of what, not their biology, but what people define themselves as being human, born of Earth and all. They said they called themselves the star people, you know, that they came from. They originally, when he asked where do you come from, he pointed up. And he says, now, I don't mean, you know, just up there. He means we are not from, you know, the whole planet. We're not from here. And if you'll, you know, if you, we speak to the star people, we are the star people. And that was just their long-term tradition passed on verbally, or, you know, through their own writings. And that's how they feel about themselves. That's their reflection on who they are. And
well,
they don't need to be told that, you know, this created them or that created them. They have their story and they're sticking to it.
Yeah. Well, and this is where the ugly side of religion comes in that you brought up earlier. And you know, I think we need to talk more about the religious aspects. But remember that a lot of the explorations in the 14th, 15th, hundreds were done by order of the Pope as well.
Yeah.
And they went looking for riches and ancient wisdom, bring the riches back and destroy the wisdom and replace it with the Bible.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what they did. So they did the best they could to destroy indigenous knowledge and indigenous wisdom, burn as much of it as they can, and replace it with the Bible and the dogma that they brought with them, mm-hmm. The oppressive tools. And once again, I need to stress that I'm not saying the Bible is a bad book. The Bible is filled with all the knowledge and information we need, but it's encoded, it's deeply encoded and covered beneath storylines that have been misinterpreted by those that have turned religion into dogma.
The dogma, exactly.
So, over 600 African stories of mythology are in agreement and say the same thing, that, you know, the star people or the sky people or the sky gods came down from the stars and created the African people. And the next question is, well, to do what? And the answer is to mine the gold.
Mm. Right.
And this is well known specifically in the Zulu tradition that was described to me by the preeminent South African Sangoma and Shaman, Credo Mutwa, yeah.
Yeah.
And Credo has written, you know, phenomenal information that he has pretty much leaked. And I believe he made himself very unpopular for doing that, but he felt that the time was right. This is what he told me, the time was ripe, that he shared this hidden ancient secrets with the rest of humanity, because he felt people needed to know this, need to know what the origins are and how we've been manipulated by the colonialists. Yeah. And
That's amazing. And you met him and talked to him, and so let's drill down into that. Could you tell us the story of man's creation? Could you tell us a Reader's Digest version of humanity's creation?
Okay, this is how it goes, right? And anything else is lies and fiction, and and you better believe this story only from now on, otherwise you will
exactly
be in eternity in hell.
Until I discover some other stuff which might change it next week.
All right. Okay, well then you're going to burn in hell for a week.
Yeah, okay.
Whoops. Right. So basically the African knowledge keepers tell us the following, that the Abelungu, and they come by various names, but Abelungu is just one of the names, which are the sky gods. And incidentally, Abelungu is a reference to the fact that they were pale sky gods. They were of light skin color, which is also important because that coincides with the Sumerian tablets and what we read in those translations. And the sky gods came down and they created the African people. They came to Africa and they created the people to mine gold. And they set up the ancient gold mines, and they gave them the knowledge and the technology and the tools to do that. And they also gave them other information and wisdom. And that's the basis of many African belief systems. There are obviously hundreds and hundreds of subtle variations on this theme, but ultimately that's where it comes down to. And, you know, there are more than 2,000 indigenous stories of this ancient event called the Flood. And once again, how long did it take us to realize that the biblical flood was just a pulling together of all these individual and indigenous stories of this major event that destroyed the whole world a long, long time ago? It is now commonly agreed that this flood happened around 11,500 BC. That's the most common number thrown out and accepted by archaeologists and geologists and geophysicists. So I use that number at about 12,500 years ago or 13,000 years ago as the great flood of the Bible.
Nice.
That pretty much destroyed the world and brought in the modern era of history, the post-diluvian period, which is completely different and completely removed from what happened before the flood.
Right.
And that's important to highlight for a lot of people, to draw that distinction. Because from my findings and the physical evidence that I'm finding in the millions of stone ruins of Southern Africa, the technology they used, the structures they built, the mining that they were involved in, we're dealing with a completely different paradigm of civilization or existence, totally different to how we perceive it today. And that's really important and fascinating, because that brings us to what I call my concept of contributionism and this whole new world without money, which I believe we're moving towards very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's strange that we find our origins in Africa as a species, and at the same time we seem to be going back to those origins for some fundamental philosophical answers for how we need to survive in the modern world right now. And those answers come to us in the form of the infrastructure that they had, the settlements, the kind of settlements and communities that they lived in, the mm-hmm. energy sources they used, and then obviously the what they were doing. They were mining gold. What right. was the gold for? And it's becoming very obvious now that the gold was not for jewelry or enrichment of any sort. It had nothing to do with that, which is a huge problem for many people, because that, you know, when you mention the word gold, it immediately means wealth, fortune,
riches,
money,
yeah,
you know, exorbitant wealth and that kind of stuff. It's got nothing to do with that.
What does it have to do with?
It's got everything to do with spirituality and the rise of consciousness. And is that not our main obsession right now? Is okay. spirituality, rise of consciousness,
okay.
finding sources of free energy.
Okay. How does gold connect to consciousness?
Well, the gold, obsession with gold, is probably one of the best kept secrets since the earliest of times on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask any scientist or physicist, what is up with gold? What is it with gold? You know, they just shake their head in confusion.
Mm-hmm.
I just had this happen to me last week. Said there is no scientific explanation or reason why gold should be so valuable or should be so sought after and traded on the stock market for whatever reason it's traded. There's a whole of other reasons why gold has become so valuable, because it has very few applications in society as we know it today.
It's pretty.
We can do without gold today.
Yeah.
That's what they tell you. And for those that have studied this more detail, will realize that the gold is directly linked to the gods. They wanted the gold. So what did they want the gold for? Well, some of the translations from Sumerian tablets tell us that they wanted to protect their planet from external, you know, rays, cosmic rays and X-rays and all kinds of rays that were affecting the climate on their planet.
Yes, yeah, that would be the Zachariah Sitchin stuff. Other writings, though, talk about it as white gold powder, manna from heaven, and these sorts of references.
Well, that is what has probably been the best kept secret for thousands of years. Because if a few, you know, even 2 decades ago, you mentioned the word white powder of gold or manna from heaven and linked the two together, people would look at you as if you, you know, dropped from down to earth from Mars, right? And right now, it is one of the fastest growing areas in my area of research. One of the fastest growing areas of interest is the monoatomic gold and the white powder of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the great fortune of meeting up with David Hudson in Phoenix on my tour of the USA.
Okay.
And we had lunch and another dinner the following day, where I had the opportunity to get a lot of information from David on the monoatomic gold and so forth, and realize how absolutely amazing this aspect of gold is. because right. I got it from the guy who's actually done it, who's not just been speaking about it, but has created and manufactured monatomic gold and white powder of gold,
right.
and how it exists and how unstable it is in certain conditions, and what it binds to, how it likes to be kept in a physical form so that it doesn't degrade or deteriorate, and we can consume it, and all these aspects. So to explain to your listeners briefly, gold, its atomic number is 79, and just that alone is a hugely important number, because since we live in a numeric matrix, a numeric prison grid, which is this projected reality that we call the universe, is all based on numbers and geometry and sacred geometry, that everything needs to be connected. If it's not connected in some way, it can't exist in this projected reality. And it seems that gold is inextricably linked to the energy sources of this planet and its consciousness, and how it affects us when we consume it. There have been some interesting discoveries in Egypt when they, I don't know if you saw this article, I think it was in National Geographic, about a year and a half ago, they dug up some mummy and they analyzed the hair of this mummy. It was a female, and they said the amount of gold deposits in the hair of the mummy was so extraordinarily high that the only conclusion they could make was that this person was drinking liquid gold.
Ah.
And it's really interesting to read these kind of stories from mainstream, you know, magazines and newspapers, when they make these discoveries and they give us this information, not really being aware of what truth hides behind
that
information.
Yeah, they're not making the connections that say you would make.
Yeah, exactly. That. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, you know, we're talking about gold. So gold exists in a diatomic form because of the one electron, the loose electron in its outer orbit that wants to bind to something else, and it likes to bind most to itself. So it binds to another atom of gold, and it creates a diatomic bond of gold. And that is what we know as gold. But okay. when you take that single atom of gold and you bind it to something else, whether it's salt or hydroxide or something else, many other things you can bind it to, it forms different bonds. And suddenly gold no longer looks the way that we recognize it as a gold shiny metal, but it takes on a completely different form.
Yeah.
And so David Hudson discovered this in the late 70s and early 80s and started manufacturing this monatomic gold, realizing that this is the stuff that the Bible talks about as the manna from heaven and food of the gods and so forth. And this is what they were ingesting. They were eating this stuff because of its specific effects on our bodies and what it does to us. What it seems to do is it elevates our frequencies and our psychic abilities. It activates our pineal gland. It activates all the senses, because it turns your entire nervous system into, and your DNA, which is linked to that, not obviously directly, but linked to it in the interesting connections in your body.
Okay.
You turn your entire body into a higher frequency conductor of light and information, because the monatomic gold is actually a superconductor which conducts information instantaneously from one end to the other. So no information can be withheld or retarded or distorted in any way, and you become this being of light with absolute knowledge and consciousness,
right.
that doesn't have to communicate with speech, that can communicate with ESP, and also has the ability, and this is where it gets really interesting,
okay. Okay.
Has the ability, when you get to a certain level of higher frequencies, to transmutate, to exist in the physical form, or just disappear and, you know, dematerialize into the ether and then rematerialize somewhere else.
Yeah, I've done quite a bit of study on the gold. It's becoming increasingly more difficult to get a hold of it, and now it's been very specific on how it's the correct formula or the correct formulas for it.
Yeah,
and you got to be careful. Well, when buying white gold powder liquid, because there's it's a firecracker. And yeah, maybe there's people out there not selling the good stuff. I was recently talking to someone who was taking Mega Hydrate to cure him from 4-stage cancer, and it absolutely worked at one point, and another point some things happened to him and his frequencies got changed and that was no longer working. So he got a hold of a good source of white gold powder, and he found the liquid, and he was taking that, and because he got the cancer again, and then he said it wiped it right out, cleaned his whole system right out. Like, just, it was amazing, really, the healing of it.
Yeah,
and that's just another aspect of it. Have you heard of that before?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what it does, because it activates your DNA. It corrects your DNA. It corrects the golden mean ratio aspect of your DNA, so that it functions properly. And by doing that, it activates the dormant parts of your DNA, which, as we know, are huge. Most of our DNA is unused.
Mm-hmm.
I still believe that what we think we know about our DNA is just scratching the surface. The actual work of the DNA is encoded in holographic information that is carried in light, specific frequencies in light of light that activate certain parts of our DNA to allow us to do certain things. And this is what we get from this white powder of gold, because of its emission of this frequency of light, this white light that David Hudson refers to, which is radiant light. It has no frequency.
Okay.
It cannot be measured. And this was his biggest problem, is, you know, he was getting flack from the institutions and the universities and government say, well, you know, you can't prove any of this. You can't measure it. So until you can measure it and show us proof of the stuff, you know, you're just a hacker. You're just a con artist.
Yeah, yeah. Snake oil salesman, yeah.
Exactly. But how can you prove this is, and this is what he explained to me in great detail, is that how can you measure something when our most advanced scientific tools are not capable of measuring it? So yeah, that's the problem. It's now reached a stage where that is understood in much greater detail. And mm-hmm, from what I understand, David has found a method of doing this, of actually proving the transmutation of solid matter into something else.
Okay. That's interesting. Well, we're sorry, but we got to take a quick break right now, and we'll see you guys on the other side.
Are you suffering from constant pain in the knee, shoulder, wrist, and other parts of your body? Needle-free acupuncture with Lapingo Life Pads may be the answer. Lapingo Life Pads combine ancient wisdom with modern nanotechnology and advanced engineering. They're designed to relieve pain naturally with no needles and no side effects. That's Lepingo, lapingoproducts.com.
Hello, this is Scott Jordan, and I would personally like to thank all of our listeners for their emails of encouragement. It means a great deal to us. All of Spectrum shows are available in two formats, an MP3 stream you can listen to on our site, as well as a YouTube version. All of Spectrum shows are full length and free to listen to, and if I have my way, always will be. Tom and myself do all this work out of pocket, and freely give our time and effort to giving you, the listener, the best, most informative experience possible. I would also like to thank our listeners who have donated in the past to help with our expenses. Every donation goes directly to keeping the project alive. Thank you, enjoy, and keep listening.
You've always been told to think about the alternative. Well, we can do better. We can show you. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com will improve your health, well-being, and lifestyle through hundreds of different products, from herbs and well-being products to our large selection of specialty clothing, jewelry, and more. We ship around the world with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. There's always new products and amazing specials. Let us show you at AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com.
That's funny. You were just talking about, you were just about to give us the secret of what this gentleman discovered and how he can prove that it's having an effect, and you dropped off the line. So we've got Michael back, and he's going to hopefully try to tell us again.
Yeah, I sort of lost my train of thought, but you know, the fact that the David Hudson explained to me how this white powder of gold, you know, you can't measure it with any tools. It has no magnetic effect. It's just this clump of white powder, fluffy white powder. When they start heating it up at a specific temperature, it starts to lose its weight almost immediately. But and it gradually loses its weight as you increase the temperature in degrees Celsius. And then at about between 700 and 800 degrees Celsius, it just disappears. At first, the weight of the product drops down to 5/9 of its original weight, and see that is a huge problem for physicists and scientists and chemists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is that possible? You know, you've got to be able to show what happened to the other weight.
Right.
The sample has to remain the total, the original weight of the sample that you started with, or you got to be able to show how it transformed itself into something else that is, that you can demonstrate with known science. Well, that's not the case with this product. This product reduces its weight to 5/9 of the original weight, and this is very important information because that was already suggested by some other physicists a long time ago, that as you approach anti-gravity has this aspect of 5/9 worked into it somehow. I need to still wrap my head around that and understand how it would describe from the perspective of Newtonian physics, because that's where it came from, which is really interesting that a physicist could make such a conclusion and be absolutely spot on, because that's what David Hudson found. He said that's it, the, you know, 40%, more or less 40% of the, or something like that, of the material just disappears, and cannot be accounted for. And then at between 700 and 800 degrees Celsius, the white powder just vanishes. It disappears from in front of your eyes and vanishes. And you know, this is not something that mainstream science takes kindly to.
Does it come back?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
That's the magic. Now, this is important information because David Hudson is not the only guy that has done this, because David Wilcock has been talking about his research and the experiments that he was involved with some of these Russian scientists, where they do pretty much what Willem de Swart and I have been toying with and playing with in our research in what we call the secret numbers of God, and working out from the aspect of geometry, or what I call the sacred geometry, and in the greater name that we now gave it is the numeric science. The numeric science that is the numeric matrix that holds, that is responsible for the projected universe and projected reality.
Mm-hmm. The holographic universe, the matrix.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the secret numbers of God that Willem de Swart has been decoding and I've been party to in some ways is spectacular, because it has predicted in the formulas, and these are simple sacred geometry-based formulas, not formulas based on Newtonian physics or mathematics.
Right.
This is something else. And the formulas and the conclusions that we've reached show us very clearly what should happen and what happens to matter, and what are the reasons that govern its physical appearance, why things materialize and dematerialize, and so forth. And it's fascinating that the numbers that we work with are exactly the numbers that David Hudson just very casually gave me over lunch.
Really?
Not realizing that he was telling me something that we predict with our secret numbers of God. And that just nearly, actually, I nearly fell off my chair when he told me this.
Wow. And so does, I'm going to probably jump again here, but does this connect to the stone circles, this sort of geometry that you're talking about?
Absolutely. You see, and this is where, once again, you come back and say, what the hell are these guys going on about? I thought they're going to tell me about ancient civilizations and ancient gold mining in South Africa and the Sumerians and the Anunnaki and Enki, and this is all connected. These are the guys that introduced the early humans to the technology to do all this stuff. And all this knowledge and information has been encoded, and the symbols that we find surrounding us in Freemasonry, in secret societies, in the Catholic Church, in the Vedas, in the ancient cultures all over the world, all the symbology that has been used for thousands and thousands of years, captures this information and gives us this information in symbols, but we have forgotten and lost the ability to understand and decode these symbols. And this is what Willem de Swart pretty much has done, decoded these symbols. That's why we call it secret numbers of God, because it all comes down to number and geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And what's important is that we are here discussing all this stuff because a group of advanced beings, predominantly the Anunnaki, specifically in the case of the human race as we know it today, came to Earth in search of gold. And they found gold in spectacular amounts, and they started to mine it in spectacular fashion, in such large quantities that will boggle the mind today.
Right.
And they use that gold for all kinds of things, and specifically, I believe, only sometime after arriving on Earth did they discover its monatomic properties and, you know, the white powder of gold, or as the Bible calls it, manna from heaven.
Right.
And they started realizing that when they eat it, when they consume it, it is this amazing elixir that gives you virtually eternal life and eternal youth, and connects you to the consciousness of the universe.
Right.
And
Sorry, Michael. What do you think is the problem right now that we, at the stage that we're in right now, we don't accept, or we're afraid to accept, you know, that these star people may have put us here?
Well, that is, once again, you have to delve right into the deep end of conspiracy,
right,
which, as we know, if you follow conspiracy theories, it's not conspiracy; it's just information, and there's no conspiracy there. It's just information, and some people are not ready to absorb that information, so they call it conspiracy.
Right.
And I believe that we were specifically allowed to, well, we were given so-called civilization. Let's put it this way.
Right.
We're told that civilizations evolved, you know, and this has happened after the flood. Remember I mentioned earlier that the big dividing line in human history is the Great Flood. Because after the flood, you see the emergence of the first, what we call today, civilization. Well, that is actually where the disinformation begins, truly begins. And that disinformation started being written down and captured by the Sumerians.
Right.
As they were informed and told to capture it by the Anunnaki, or the gods.
Right.
and they started to set up, you know, cities and towns, and they were taught agriculture, and they were taught, they were introduced to the concept of money, they were introduced to the concept of hierarchy, of kings and priests, and the feudal system that created a hierarchical system that you were answerable to your king or your priest, who was answerable to the king, who was answerable to the high priest, who was answerable to the gods. Yeah, and
right.
this is what we get. And the legal system that we use today is originally handed down to us by the Sumerians from the Code of Hammurabi, and even some older fundamental codes that came to us before the Code of Hammurabi that were the foundations of the legal system that has evolved into what we call the Roman Dutch law today.
Now,
and this is spectacular information. And you know what? It's all written in the Sumerian tablets. It is all there for us to read and actually go, oh my God, they're telling us all this information. But once again, you know, we have been very carefully manipulated, meticulously manipulated into a state of very high and very advanced amnesia and ignorance, and which is associated with arrogance and ego. These guys are so good at developing these structures of hierarchy and ego and control that and the education system is directly linked to that.
Yeah, it's almost like a long-term, the civilized world's long-term amnesia.
Oh, gee, I tell you, it is spectacular. And we think that you go to school, then you go to high school, then you go to university, and then when you graduate, you carry on, and you get your master's, and then you get your doctorate, and then you get your PhD, and you become a professor, and all this. And all that you're doing is you're becoming more and more indoctrinated by the dogma of mainstream academia, right? So the more educated you are, the more dangerous you actually probably are to society. And this is a spectacular, and I know a lot of people are going to probably throw stones at me when they hear this.
Yeah.
But, and these are the people with the PhDs and the doctorates behind their names who are now the highly educated people, and those that are in the field of law and the financial systems that are in positions of power, because they are the most indoctrinated ones.
Yeah.
And with the higher education, the higher your ego becomes, if you allow yourself to be absorbed or swallowed into that system, right? Your ego grows with the level of your education. And then you get put on top of the pile because that's how they've structured it.
Yep.
So now you've got an idiot at the top of a pile because he's the most indoctrinated individual, but he's got the highest qualification, so that's how they've structured it.
Yeah.
Isn't that a brilliant system?
Yeah, he's best able to regurgitate information. You know what PhD stands for, Tom? Did I ever tell you this?
Nope, go ahead.
Piled higher and deeper.
Deeper. For sure.
Piled higher and deeper. This is interesting because there is evidence of mines in Africa that go back, you might know the numbers on this, but a ridiculously long time. And for some reason in academia, if they find things that don't fit if the puzzle piece doesn't fit with the puzzle they're trying to create, then they just throw the puzzle piece away.
Yeah.
That there are mines that are extremely old in Africa.
Oh, yeah. Well, Peter Beaumont is the archaeologist in South Africa. He had another partner whose name I forget now, but Peter Beaumont has been, I think he's still working on this excavation site called Vonderwerk Caves, which is a spectacular cave which shows like more than 1 million years of habitation. But we're talking now specifically about advanced civilizations with advanced knowledge.
And advanced mining techniques.
And mining techniques. And Peter Beaumont, in the 60s or 70s already, he discovered several of these ancient mines. One particular one, which is an ancient iron mine. And
And he, you know, he made some statements that could be interpreted as that this mine is more than 100,000 years old. You know, I think his own statements were that the mine was at least 50,000 years old,
mm-hmm.
and probably a lot older based on the on the tools and artifacts and things that they found in the various strata layers. And then he also found an interesting statue of a Caucasian face in Africa. A statue of a Caucasian face and a Caucasian head that he dated to being about 30,000 years old. But that information is not shared with anybody. I've got a photograph of that Caucasian head. It's in the McGregor Museum in the town of Kimberley in South Africa.
Oh,
and there it is, just lying there, as you know, and they write it off as some sculpture done by local people 200 or 300 years ago. And that's not what Peter Beaumont found when he first discovered it. He made it very clear that that's an ancient carving and cannot be ascribed to recent activity.
Okay, so we're getting a story forming.
I have one kind of I don't want to call it crazy question, but I'm you know, an obvious question that a lot of people ask me. Were we put here, or were we made here?
I think the first one was we were, as far as the human race goes, but already there you start having problems because the human race consists of several race groups.
Exactly.
So it seems that certain race groups were a later addition to the original primordial race group. It seems to me that the first race of humans on Earth was a dark-skinned human, dark red skin color, which the Sumerian tablets refer to.
Right.
It's interesting that the Bushmen of South Africa or the Kun or the Sand people refer to themselves as the Red People, and the Sumerian tablets refer to Adamu or the biblical Adam.
Adam, yeah.
as having a dark red skin, as the same color as the clay of the Abzu, and the Abzu is referred to as the place where the gold came from. And I have discovered, you know, millions of gold mines that I have circumstantial evidence and some physical evidence for, millions of gold mines linked to the millions of circular stone structures in southern Africa, that clearly this is what the Sumerian tablets refer to as the Abzu, and where Enki created his gold mining empire starting about 285,000 years ago with the first slave humans. So I believe that the answer your question, were we put here, were we made here, is a multifaceted answer. Once again, it's not a simple answer. Originally the gold mining slaves were created here.
Right.
And then something else happened and we got mixed up with other beings from other planets and other star systems of different skin colors and created a whole variety of race groups that has caused a lot of problems for us on this planet.
But not too long ago, there was a couple of shows on television, I think was produced, I can't remember if it was History Channel or one of those type of things, where it showed, they followed the genes of, the first, what was thought to be the first human.
Yes.
from Africa, and they followed the genes throughout, you know, the world. Wow. And showed that, you know, we went to Europe and Asia and so on and so forth. How do we, you know, how is that explained?
Well, that can be explained very easily. What you mentioned there is important because they've now, you know, published a number of papers on the fact that the oldest DNA in humans can be identified in the Bushmen, the Kum or the Sand people, as I mentioned, in South Africa, that call themselves the Red People. Now, I'm not suggesting for one second that these were the original people that were the slaves or created as the slaves, but they certainly are very close descendants of those original people that probably were created as the slaves. Mm. There have certainly been a number of exoduses from Africa, and we also know that the gods, the Anunnaki, brought some of these early slaves from Africa, from the Abzu,
up to the Near East, where they had their palaces and their temples and where they were practicing worshiping and sacrifice and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So the movement of the original African people was as a result of them being moved by the gods, the Anunnaki, those who created them, to different parts of the world to perform menial tasks, being slaves for them.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, also on their own, where people actually on their own were allowed to leave. And that becomes a really interesting moment in human history as well, because, you know, they've been talking about this exodus from Africa, right? All kinds of numbers have been thrown out. And originally, I think it was 50,000 years ago, and then they keep moving it up. And at the moment, I think they're sitting at somewhere at 75,000 years ago, the exodus from Africa happened.
Right.
I find it interesting that that coincides with the supervolcano of the Lake Toba event in Sumatra, 70 to 75,000 years ago. Now, many environmentalists or people that study climate and the movement of air will tell you that those giant clouds from that supervolcano may have been taken by the prevailing winds across the Indian Ocean and down along the coast of East Africa and then onto the African continent, where right at the tip of Africa, moving across the southern tip of Africa into the Atlantic and then up again with the Atlantic current.
Okay.
And that would have caused very unpleasant conditions for the people down in southern Africa where all the gold mines were. And that seems to be, and I have heard somewhere, I've not followed up on this, so I need to do this, but I have heard that there is evidence and deposits in South Africa that have been found of the volcanic ash from the Sumatra Lake Toba event.
Oh.
And if that's the case, you know, if you find any of that, please let me know. If that's the case, then that'll most certainly explain why the exodus from Africa happened at that time.
Yeah, time to go. Yeah.
But are we not pretty defined on the fact that, you know, there are different races? Even though, you know, we're the same type of species.
We're bipedal with two arms, two legs, a head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we are races.
We're different race groups, absolutely. The
so in my you know, thinking, if you know, if when we take animals, for instance, and we breed them, you know, to change their colors, their looks, and so on, you know, we can come up with all kinds of fancy designs. But back in the day when humans were, you know, may have gone out of Africa or, you know, have gone to different areas, that doesn't explain, you know, if we start with one particular, you know, type of race, how did we evolve to having these different ones?
Well, we didn't evolve into the other race groups. We are manipulated.
But that's the idea they give us, though.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, because that's mainstream academia once again. You know, they take the concept of evolution, and they just screw that into the ground as deeply as they can, and make everybody learn that at school. And they put it in your face over and over and over again. Look, we evolved out of monkey. Look, mommy. Look, daddy. And they go show you those beautiful pictures of the apes, and then they more upright apes, and then more upright walking on two legs, and eventually it's the Neanderthal, and then suddenly, look, there's intelligent Homo sapien. And they show you this evolutionary upright motion, and then suddenly they use this. That's actually, if you think about it, that is probably the most compelling and convincing argument that the anthropologists hold in our faces as evidence of evolution. Look, we've evolved out of these, you know, creatures, and here we are walking upright and we have intelligence. Mm. And they show that picture of the, you know, the ever-increasing upright walking human.
Yeah, look, the only example of macroevolution on the entire planet just includes humans.
Yep.
We're the exception to the rest of the planetary species.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I had a hobby quite a number of years back, and I was raising chinchillas. You know, chinchilla, the normal color that, you know, when they come out from the Andes there in South America, they're gray. You know, that's their normal color. And, you know, when we interbreed them, you know, we can make them, you know, change colors into black and white and so on. But if you, you know, the species that exists, you know, the original species in the mountains there have never changed their color, you know, throughout millennia. So if humans, you know, were able to even travel, you know, at that time for in whatever mode of transportation that would have had to be able to go all over the world, could they have created this race situation that you know, I mean, logically, how would that work?
Tom, I think what you're saying here is if you take those original chinchillas from the Andes, pick them up, move them over to some other part of the planet that has a different environment or, you know,
yeah.
You know, access to sunshine, yada, 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 that it's not, they're going to stay the same. They're not going to magically change.
They're not going to change.
There's not going to be no macro evolution there. You said that you had to manipulate.
You have to manipulate them in order to do so, yes.
Bingo.
So how?
And totally, guys, you're spot on, and this is an argument, and I think we must just, you know, put this to rest and just call it what it is and say we are not the human race. We are the human races. We're distinctly different race groups that remain distinctly different. You know, the people, the blue blonde-eyed people from Scandinavia are not suddenly going to come out dark and black and curly-haired. The curly-haired people of Africa are not suddenly going to come out blonde and blue-eyed. They remain what they are. That's their race. And clearly there's been some serious genetic manipulation by other race groups or other ETs and messing with the DNA to create different race groups.
And multiple. Not just one, multiple. Because if just going to flip over here for a second, you can answer that and finish that thought off. But I'm going to just throw this at Credo also talks about the Chitahori. I may have said that incorrectly, so you can correct me as well. But he talks about the Chitahori, and the Chitahori were, I believe, that they were a different race as well.
Yeah. Now, Credo talks about a number of different race groups, absolutely. He also talks about the reptilians, but now we're going down a whole nother rabbit hole. Because, once again, we need to remind people that the history of this planet is a lot stranger than most people care to realize.
Or want to,
I think, for the most part, yeah.
So, what's important to get back to is that, you know, these early humans that were created to mine the gold is not what we are today. I don't know if there are any remnants of those early humans that were doing the gold mining in southern Africa. And I'm not quite sure which of the existing race groups are the closest to those early humans, whether it's the African people, whether it's the Bushmen, whoever it may be. But it's probably going to be some of the African tribes, or the Bushmen, or a combination thereof, that were the early humans created by the Anunnaki, and then the messing of the DNA continued for thousands of years, creating and interbreeding. Remember, the sons of the gods saw the daughters of man, and they had children with them.
Right. Yeah.
And suddenly you start, you know, creating.
That would introduce a new stream of DNA changes.
A hybrid species, you know. Yeah. Obviously a hybrid, a new hybrid species, and then they go off and they create a new hybrid species, and very quickly you've got some serious crossing of race groups and their interesting genetic strong points that then manifest themselves and retain its the most
the strongest parts of those genetic traits.
Right.
What's important to come back to is these gold mines in Southern Africa, because what Zachariah Sitchin has been writing about, and I feel a great sense of pride in what I have been able to put together from his translations and presenting the physical evidence for what he was writing about, and taking a lot of criticism for many years, as you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have been trying to undermine him and call him a charlatan, and he's lying, and he's not translating it correctly. And, well, you know what? I think we have put this to rest, because I have presented the world with physical evidence and irrefutable proof of what Zachariah Sitchin has been writing about.
Right.
So there can be no more argument that the Abzu, as spoken about by the Anunnaki, or the Sumerian tablets and the Anunnaki, created by Enki, the Golden Empire in the Abzu, which is Southern Africa. We've identified where that is. We have, in the same breath, we've identified where King Solomon's mines were. They were in Southern Africa. There's no doubt about that.
Okay.
And this is where all the gold and wealth has come from for thousands and thousands of years.
Mm.
Until after the flood, and then everything changed.
Right. Then it almost seems like there was a growth in human consciousness and technology, and then, you know, it wiped out, or maybe multiple wipeout. You know, this, we don't just have to go back 12,500 years or 11,500 years. You know, this has happened multiple times. It's a cyclical event. There's all kinds of stuff that can happen on this earth that,
yep,
that causes major problems and near extinction level events.
Yeah.
Stragglers that have to build right back up again out of the muck, and then back down again, and back up, and back down, and back up. Now we seem to be rebuilding back up to a certain point, but the, like you said, the system of control, or the system of government, or the system of religion, all of these sort of machinations don't seem to be the case in the some of the earlier evolutions. I hate to use that term, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, the early periods on Earth. That's very obvious to me now, and this is why we can look at those as interesting models for a new social structure on planet Earth. And, you know, I talk about it as contributionism. I call it contributionism. I believe that the money system is going to collapse very soon. It can't continue the way that it has been for thousands of years now. It's every year it gets more and more desperate. And the Mayan calendar talks about time speeding up, the coming of the new age. That's a fascinating debate in itself, I tell you. That just blows my mind when you start looking at the information encoded in the whole Mayan calendar and the information there, all linked to the crossing over from space-time into time-space, or at least our ability to understand or be comfortable with a concept of existing in time-space as opposed to space-time. That is deep information that is encoded in the whole 2012 and the physical projection of this projected reality we call the universe. And I deal with that in The Secret Numbers of God as well, with Willem de Swart. And fascinating stuff. But I'd like to just talk to you as well, if I may, about the energies and the sound frequencies that these ancients were using in the mines and in the settlements in Southern Africa and in South Africa, because we've left that out, and I think that's important. A lot of people are very interested in that, the sound aspects.
Yeah, I know that you have some ringing stones. Whether that's connected or not, I don't know, but you have these stones that if you tap them, they have like a ringing tone to them. They resonate.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is, and it's, you know, I call them stones that ring like bells, and that was a major breakthrough in my personal journey on this research, and that helped me to jump very rapidly to some major conclusions when I realized that we're dealing with specific stones that have very strong acoustic properties.
Now, are these crafted, or are they just hunks of stone that ring?
No, these are the stones that were used to build the walls of the stone structures.
Okay.
Okay, so these, and they vary from, you know, 10 kilograms up to 2 tons.
Okay. Okay.
And then Adam's calendar, which is the centerpiece of it all, which is actually, we now know, is directly linked to Enki. So I'm starting to call it Enki's calendar. And that goes back to, according to my calculations, about 285,000 years ago. That's the centerpiece among more than 10 million of these stone structures.
So and there's a possibility that there was a technique of using the ringing stones to levitate large objects. Is that possible? Now, wouldn't they also need, you just don't get a bunch of people together, grab some stones and start banging on them and your chair lifts off the floor. I mean, there would be an ancient encoded technique of doing that. And wouldn't you also have to have some sort of psychic skill to be able to will the interaction?
Yeah, I think it's a lot simpler than that once you know the laws of nature.
Okay.
This is when it becomes really beautiful and the information starts to unfold very rapidly. It's just the understanding of the use of sound as a source of energy. And, you know, Nikola Tesla gave us very clear indicators that he used sound frequencies as his source of energy that he converted into his radiant energy. John Keeley used sound for the same purposes, for everything he did. Sound, his musical dynasphere, for levitation, for crushing giant rocks, for drilling holes, for everything. He used sound as a source of energy. The Tibetan monks do that today still. And then Royal Rife cured disease with sound and light and electromagnetic frequencies and frequencies of specific color as well, with sound being the primordial source there. The stones in Stonehenge were chosen for their acoustic properties because Stonehenge is an energy-generating device.
Wow.
And while we're talking about Stonehenge, incidentally, I can categorically tell you that Stonehenge is at least 1 million years old. This is a big shock to a lot of people.
That's a huge. Okay, tell me why you think Stonehenge is 1 million years old.
I'm going to use this as a bait. You got to get the people that listen to the show must come to my presentation and I'll show you the proof.
Okay, that's okay. Good. And we'll put Michael's schedule up on his profile page so you know what city he's going to be in and when. I can condense all that and throw it on your bio.
Right, but it's irrefutable evidence. It's, you know, it's geology. The geology doesn't lie. It will only tell us the truth, and we can extract the truth if we know what it is we're looking at. And I'm astounded to see that for hundreds of years, people have been going to Stonehenge and some of the smartest minds in the world, and they've been staring at the information and the evidence lying right in front of them, and they have not seen it. It's absolutely staggering that it's taken me completely by surprise. And I use this geological evidence to show you that Stonehenge is way more than 1 million years old because of the simple erosion on some of the stones that seem to have broken in recent times. But that's not what the geology tells us. So I'll leave that as a clue for you, and I'll show you in great examples with some lovely photographs that I've taken Stonehenge to support the statement.
Wow.
Michael, I had a one of the arguments that I get when we talk about stuff like that is that why haven't these star people came back to, you know, see their work?
Yeah. Well, the first and obvious answer that a lot of people will give you, and I love this answer, is by asking that question, you assume that they left.
Yeah.
And why should we assume that they left? They're still here. The mining continues. We are mining this planet more aggressively today than at any time in human history. We're mining every possible thing you can imagine. We mine out of the ground. We are raping this planet of her natural energy sources and her natural energy fields that are the expression of the consciousness, which through the consciousness comes the expression of the sacred geometry that is responsible for forming all the stuff on this planet. And we are just ripping it out of the guts of this planet, destroying all the energy fields and the flow of natural flow of energy through this planet. And she doesn't like it.
Of course.
So the answer to that is they haven't left. Some of them have left. Some of them have stayed behind. Many more have come in and have been living among us. And I'm talking about the star people and the aliens or the ETs. And some of them have been very, you know, good for us, and some of them have been very deeply detrimental to us, causing huge amounts of trauma and harm to the human race. And the mining continues, and the metals and the materials are constantly being taken off this planet, especially the gold, because nothing has changed. It is still utilized as a source of food and energy and a source of enlightenment for many of the ETs, especially the Anunnaki. And it seems that they're coming back. I don't know if you saw the latest information that I just saw it a few days ago that absolutely blew my mind. The big question is, you know, when are the Anunnaki coming back? When is Nibiru coming back?
Yeah.
And it's a difficult question to answer, because which point do you use as a point of reference in history to try and do the calculation?
Right.
You know, it's difficult to do that. But there's been some interesting talk about this brown dwarf. Already a few years ago, they spotted this brown dwarf, and it was very close to Earth. It was like unbelievably close, and they weren't sure what the hell was going on. How can it be so close to Earth? You know, it's just outside our solar system, and it seems to be moving towards us. It's this brown dwarf with some planets around it. Well, that brown dwarf is potentially not necessarily a brown dwarf, but a giant red planet with some moons around it, and it looks as if there are four moons around it. And people go onto YouTube and just look for Nibiru. You'll find some photographs of this that were taken from the Southern Pole Telescope. And this either brown dwarf or planet is approaching Earth, and it has got either four planets or four moons around it that are visible now when the photographs were taken. What happened next is that this information just very quickly vanished off the internet. The photographs vanished, but fortunately people have, you know, kept copies of it. One of the copies that has been kept is retained, has the actual coordinates for this planet approaching Earth. I've looked at those coordinates myself, and to my horror, that entire area of the sky has been blacked out, so you cannot see it.
Blacked out by who?
Well, this is on Google Sky.
Oh, Google Sky, yeah.
Google Sky. Until recently, you could see it, and you could go there and have a look at those coordinates and actually see that planet approaching us, or the brown dwarf with the planets, and now it's no longer visible. It's been blacked out. Now, that immediately tells me that there's something there that they don't want us to see. And
Astronomers able to have, I mean, strong enough equipment to be able to see?
I suppose they have, and we need to look at those to find those solutions. So if you have any contacts with amateur astronomers or astronomy groups, please disseminate this information.
Okay. Are those coordinates available somewhere?
Yes, I will give you those coordinates. I made a copy of it. I'll look for it after this interview and email it to you, and maybe we can send that information out.
I will put that to as many people as possible. I will put that in your bio as well.
Any
amateur astronomers want to go to these coordinates and check it out and get us a report back, we'll put it up in the news section of our website. I'll also post in the news section your schedule, and I'll put it in your bio as well. And we'll have that information up. Definitely. Absolutely. I mean, sure, could Nibiru be coming back? I don't know. Apparently it does cyclically come back to, into our system. And that's what the research is showing. It's the when of it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's a lot. Yeah. The thing that seems to be going on now, and not just in America and Canada and other areas, is a breaking down or a collapsing. And you usually have a collapsing just before, you have a resurfacing or a rebuilding, as it were. So I don't know. I know that this seems to be a cyclical event that happens here. And we just seem to be seeing everything falling apart. And maybe that's an engineered falling apart. Maybe they're tweaking it and helping it along. Or it's just a natural process. I don't know. But certainly the economic aspect of it is man-made.
Well, for us, 3,200 years or 3,600 year cycle is a very long period of time. We can't comprehend that.
Right.
The way that our DNA functions and the short lifespans we have. And the short lifespans we have are very, very consciously, very, specifically created so that we don't live long enough to remember things, and we die very quickly, and our offspring are easily manipulated through disinformation and indoctrination and so forth.
And this doesn't seem to be always to have been the case, because if you look into ancient writings, the Bible included, you have people with longer lifespans that are in these pages, that are in this information, in this ancient writing.
Absolutely.
That there used to be a longer lifespan, and now it's almost like we've been tweaked and manipulated and, to have a set amount of a lifespan.
Yeah, look, the Anunnaki seem to live eternally. They live hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years.
Yeah.
That's staggering information. And many of the Anunnaki representatives or the gods that were on Earth in charge of certain areas ruled for 40,000 years or more.
Yeah.
So when you rule for 40,000 years and then you've done your little stint on Earth and you move back to where you came from, these people have long spans of life. It seems like they are immortal. And this immortality comes at a price, because you can't be immortal and being a being of low consciousness, because you're going to create huge amounts of damage in the universe. If that's the mix and the ratio you represent, equation is just wrong. You need to be to be immortal. You need to be a being of light and high consciousness, so that you spread the consciousness and the divine seeds of propagate that consciousness as a divine form of life that gets created all over the place, which seems to be the case from the great sun at the galactic center that the ancient cultures all talk about, right?
Right.
But we've forgotten that as well. So the amazing thing is that as we are hurtling towards 2012, this information is just speeding up and reaching us at a faster and faster pace.
Yeah.
And we're discovering valuable and critical information from the ancient civilizations in Southern Africa regarding free energy, using sound and frequency as a source of energy, which I can tell you categorically because I've measured it. I've measured the stone circles and I've measured Adam's calendar. And I can tell all the doubting Thomases out there, there is no doubt whatsoever that this is what they did. They used the stone circles as energy-generating devices just like Stonehenge was used, and just like the Great Pyramid was used and other pyramids were used, energy-generating devices utilizing sound as a source. Nikola Tesla reminded us of it. And they generated huge amounts of energy in a form that we don't understand. The measurements, the electronic measurements, show us this in electromagnetic waves that we've measured there that run both horizontally and vertically, creating very strange anomalous effects that some psychics described as vortexes or portals that are still active, that are creating space-time collapse areas, and can allow you to transmutate from here or from that specific place anywhere in the universe or anywhere else in the meta-universes.
Mm-hmm.
We've measured heat signatures that just defy any kind of logic.
Right.
Coming out of the circles and outside the circles, there's absolutely no heat signature that we measure. And we measured sound frequencies that are off the charts. Sound frequencies that go up into beyond 375 gigahertz. That is higher than anything used in the United States or anywhere in the world, for that matter, in the allocation of frequencies. Allocation of frequencies ends at 300 gigahertz in the USA, and I guess in the rest of the world it's probably very similar. Nothing exists above 300 gigahertz in the allocation of frequencies. Well, we're measuring frequencies that are way beyond that in the stone circles, and specifically at Adam's calendar.
Okay, now, is this because of the type of stone? Like, if you took that type of stone outside of that configuration, that geometric configuration, if you took the stone outside of that, will it still emanate those energies? Or is it the specific arrangement of those stones that adds to this this effect?
You're a smart guy, Scott. You put your finger right into the key element here.
Okay.
The stones are very specific because of their acoustic properties. They ring like bells, which means they conduct sound frequency very effectively. But they also are able to focus the sound energy. And there we start dealing with the very specific cone-shaped tools that I've been finding. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
But the stones that ring like bells, that's why they use the specific stone because of the acoustic properties, so they can generate these sound frequencies, but they generate them because of their specific formation. You can use those stones anywhere in the world, and they'll give you the same effect. You can use other stone as well. There are many other stones, like you can use dolerite. Dolerite also has strong acoustic properties. In fact, some of the stone circles in Adam's calendar do use dolerite, but Hornfels is the main stone that seems to be used in the largest number of ruins that I've investigated myself.
Okay.
And Hornfels is a very specific South African geological formation. It's extremely hard. It's metamorphosized quartzite, but it contains large amounts of iron and aluminium, or aluminum as you call it here. And that is a very specific property that they chose because they were using sound as the source of energy. And the stone circles are actually the plug points into the sound energy fields, into the cymatic fields of Earth's sound frequencies at that specific point. And this is why all these stone circles are connected, because they generate energy by sucking it out of the Earth's surface, just like Nikola Tesla described to us, and then sharing that energy with all the other circles and the other areas that they used for, you know, crushing the stone, levitation, and so forth. So you're looking at one giant energy grid in Southern Africa that used to exist. Nothing was built separate. Everything was part of the grid. And that's a spectacular discovery.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. You've been in these circles yourself personally. Have you experienced any altered states of consciousness while being inside of them?
I certainly have had my fair share of feeling enhanced sense of energy of some weird sort that I can't really describe personally. Also, often when I go into the circles, I seem to, you mentioned this yourself earlier, I seem to just download and channel information about the events and about how it was built, what it was used for, and information that allows me to do more research or make further conclusions.
Right.
And not necessarily about that particular site, but about the larger investigation as a whole.
Okay.
But there are other people like Kerry Cassidy, for example, from Project Camelot, and even Carmen Bolter from Canada that did the Pyramid Code
right.
when she came to visit me. And various other people, hundreds and hundreds of people that have come through the ruins as my guests and as tourists, especially at Adam's Calendar. Some people walk into the circular structure of Adam's Calendar, although it is not a circle. You don't walk, you know, you don't see the circle, but it was clearly originally a circular structure, and the energy fields still only happen inside the circle. They feel physically ill. They actually feel such strong energy in there that they start to feel physically ill and they have to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So various people have experienced various personal effects. So it clearly is active. We've measured it. They're as strong today as they were when they were built, but we just don't know what to do with all this energy and how to use it.
Or how to tap it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that would be the key. It's like someone handing you an infinite energy machine and not telling you how to turn it on.
Yeah. So I believe that we're getting there. I'm hoping to attract the attention of individuals and some of these foundations that are interested in this field of study and research, because I need all the help I can get at this stage, because it's pretty much myself with independent scientists and people with interesting tools and electronic equipment that come and help me out every now and then. Most of the time I have to pay for their services. And funding at the moment, as you know, is the problematic. It's I'm the funder of everything at this stage.
I can relate. We fund everything that we do on the show, and we just put it out there. We don't have sponsors or anything like that, which is, it's all us.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's up to people like us to get the message out there and hopefully attract the attention of these organizations that are interested in this and get involved, because there is so much groundbreaking research and investigation, scientific investigation, scientific experiments that we can do, and the archaeological digs that we can do that are just mind-blowing. This will keep us busy for the rest of our lives.
I'm willing to bet that every penny that you make going to these, doing these conferences, writing your book, the proceeds from what you write in your book goes right back into the research.
No, absolutely. That's how I keep this thing going. This is why I come to the USA and to Canada to get some extra money so I can go back and carry on the research and pay the guy with his machine to come back. And, you know, one of my next things is to organize for him to come back, the guy with this technology, to come back and take photographs with his special photographic lenses to actually show you the movement of the electromagnetic waves in these stone circles.
Yeah, no, I think Michael's doing some important work right now, and we know this well ourselves, that when you're putting stuff out there, that everything you do is just comes around to putting the information out, and every aspect of your life pretty much revolves around making enough money to survive, and all extra goes to, you know, your projects, right?
Yep.
So I think people should go to Michael's conferences. Not only will you learn a tremendous amount of information, but you'll be helping support Michael to go back and continue the work that he's doing now.
Well, thanks very much for that little pun, Scott. Appreciate it.
Hi. You know what? We got to do what we can with what we have, and a lot of times what we have isn't enough.
Yeah.
And we all need help. And me and Tom were talking about this because we've been doing a series on free energy lately. We just sort of fell into it, and it's a ball that just keeps rolling. Once you get into the free energy field and research, it's like you said, it spiders out into all these other areas, but it's very time-consuming. And we found that a lot of the free energy inventors are looking for the guy to come along with the $1 million check.
Yeah.
And say, here you go, all the research funds you'll ever need. And Tom's concept is, it's not going to work that way. It's not going to happen that way. You need the support of the masses. Those are the guys that are going to support what you're doing.
Yeah, I totally agree with Tom. And I also agree, would like to add, and from what I see, we're running out of time very quickly here. But what I'd like to say is that the free energy needs to be given to the world for free.
Yes.
Yes, so, exactly. You know,
if you have the formula how to run a car on water, put it out there. Show people exactly how to do it. Don't try and make a fortune out of it. It'll bite you in the ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It will bury you.
Yeah.
It has already done so to what was his name? Steve Klein, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely did.
He died of a massive heart attack, and we know when you die of a massive heart attack suddenly just out of the blue,
where that's coming from.
Somebody has gotten to you.
And this is a recurring story in the free energy fields. Sparky Sweet, Nikola Tesla was poisoned. It goes on and on and on. All these people have been killed. Now Nikolai was one of the ones, Tesla was one of the ones that just wanted to give it to the world. Just give it. Just put it out there. Give it to the world. Free energy. JP Morgan, where do I put a meter on it? Can't put a meter on it. Boom. Operation over. If you're going to the elites to try to get them to change their game, it ain't going to happen. So if you have something and expect to be a millionaire out of it, you're working with the old paradigm thinking. And if you're working with the old paradigm thinking, you're going to crash and burn, because the old paradigm thinking is set up for you to fail.
Yeah. So, you know, I'd like to say in closing here is that this is my call to the scientific fraternity. Get in touch with me. If you have any knowledge in electronics, in electrical engineering, in alternative energy fields, get in touch with me. Get involved in the Stone Circles in South Africa. They are an infinite source of free energy. All we have to do is figure out how to use it. It's exactly the same kind of energy, I believe, that Nikola Tesla gave the world. It is right there under our noses. And we can recreate these all over the world, and we can all we need to figure out is how to tap into that energy source. They are screaming with energy at us every second of every day.
I totally agree.
And get hold of me and let's share this information.
And I'll put your email address, if that's okay, on your bio, and they can contact you directly there. I'd like to thank Michael for coming on the show. I'm so glad we finally got a hold of him and lined up our schedules correctly. And we'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks very much, Scott. Thanks, Tom. Lovely chatting to
you. Thanks, Michael.
And, take care. Yeah, hopefully we'll chat again soon.
Well, okay. Definitely. And if anything new comes up, you got to let us know.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.